The way I kind of laid this book out is I try to delay as long as possible teaching any concept, and then we're sort of forced into it. So we're sort of now, I didn't start the book by talking about App Engine or anything else. I start the book by talking about all these things. And now we're talking about forms. And now we're doomed. We really can't take another step about forms without writing server code. So that's why it's time to start doing server code. It's time to really start talking App Engine, kind of what the whole course was about in the first place. But we're at the point where if we're making forms, we've got to create active code on the server. So, does everyone have App Engine Launcher already installed? Did I make an assignment that did that? That was the first one, okay. And so, I think you all probably did this trivial Hello World application. Is that what I made everyone do on the first assignment? Okay, super awesome. So now we're going to do the next one. And by the way, if you go to appenginelearn.com and you download the sample applications, you get all the stuff from the book so that you can just steal code from that continuously. It's a really wise thing to do. And then you'll have all these things so you can run them and just sort of feed them into your App Engine launcher. And so if I go to AE01 Trivial, we'll start with this one. And I'll do it in Firefox so that I can run Firebug. And do localhost 8085. And turn Firebug on. And hit the refresh button. And so if I look at what Firebug says happened in this situation, we sent a GET request to localhost 8085. And it's a GET request, and the response is text. One of the things that comes back in the response is a content type, and that tells the browser how to display this page. And so the response to this one is not HTML. The browser was told to make this content type text plain. Now, if you look at a web page, it would say content type application HTML. So that the browser knows. So the response that came back from this program was literally, "Hello there, Bob." So if we take a quick look at... Nah, we don't need those. If we look at the AE01 Trivial folder, we see three files. We see the app.yaml file, we see the index.py, and this index.yaml file, you can ignore that. So the app.yaml file is just this static file that does routing, and you guys have learned that there's just an infinite number of ways to get that file wrong, but you just have to do it the way they do it, and what you'll do from now on is be copying this back and forth and make a few changes. And so we are actually, in this file, we are doing the HTTP response, and we're telling it that we want the content type to be text plain. We're putting a blank line. This is the HTTP response format, and then we're putting a "Hello, Bob." And so the headers, if we look at the headers, the response headers, we set that, okay? And so there's set headers that it set as well. But we are actually sending headers in addition to the text, and you separate the headers. We won't get this low level later, but this is the low, low, low level version of how this stuff works. Okay, so that is a GET request, and one thing about a GET request is you don't always force a GET request. If you hit reload, if the last request was a post request, it sends the post data again. If you hit enter here, it's always a get request. So when you're coding up, know the difference between just going into the address bar and hitting enter versus hitting reload. In this case, it was a get request, so it does the same thing. Okay, so that's our first application. So let's go to our second application. Oop. And this one's living on port 8086. So here is our number guessing application. I'll turn Firebug back on. And I'll come in here and I'll hit enter. So the actual response we got is, we'll know if this is a, we're not telling it the method here. Input, it's a post, sorry. It's a post, we got a simple form. We're gonna post to the slash URL. We are have an input type text. The value of that is guess, and then we have a button. So that the text enter guess comes out, the input type text comes out, which is a square box, we can type stuff, and then a button comes out. So if I say 25, and then I hit the submit query, it's going to do a post request. So if I look at in Firebug, it did a post request, all these headers, but then this was the post data. See, that's the post data. Now it's parsing it here, this is the raw post data. Guess equals 25 was exactly what our browser sent in. Then the response was just more HTML that came back, that now it says your guess is 25, that guess was too low, and then it throws the form up again, right? It has to, just like navigation, it has to throw this form up again. So if I do 26, submit query, it does a post. Now, here's the thing where if I do a refresh, see this thing, it says resend form data? It's saying, I'm about to send post data again. And remember that post data could be destructive or could modify information. So that's why all these browsers, when they're resending a post request, are just asking you, in case that was doing something diabolical, so that you at least know it. It's not a very good message, but browser designers feel like they've got to ask you. So I'm resending the post. So now it resends the post and it says, your guess is 26. So when I hit refresh, it's going to repost it because the last thing I did was a post. But if I want to do a get request, again, I've got to go up here in the address bar, and that's, and you see it's a get request, and you see that the guess is negative one, right? So that means it didn't get the guess. So now I make a post, I hit the refresh, it sends the same post data again. So if I look at that, the post data is guess equals 26. Okay? Yeah? No, it's not. Because it's really all just pass by value. I mean, it's really just a convention as to how to take this network connection and how to send the data. And there's just two ways of doing it. Yeah. Okay, so let's look at the slides. Okay, so as we talked about in the Python code, we talked about that somehow magically this 20 ends up in this variable guess. Oops. Okay, we talked about that. The purpose of the AppYAML, the AppYAML is effectively the router for all requests, and in the AppYAML, if we look at the AppYAML, all this is really saying is every URL we ever see, send that URL to index.py. So start the program index.py no matter what URL comes in to our application. As a matter of fact, I could put in literally any URL I want and it still is going to go to index.py. Right? So when AppYAML says asterisk here, it says slash followed by anything, send it to index.py. Now, index.py may or may not even look at that, and in this case, it's not looking at the rest of the URL once it starts up, but it doesn't care. And so that's the AppYAML is kind of a routing function. Make this bigger, get rid of that. AppYAML is kind of performing a routing function for us to get to the right code.
Is that specific to Google App Engine?
Yes, it is. It's absolutely specific to Google App Engine. There's no other system in the universe that does that. Now, if you were to do Ruby on Rails, you would find a similar thing that's called the routes table, but there are other ways, and in CakePHP, there's things that there, the concept of here comes a URL, which bit of code do I want to run, that's a common concept, but this notion of AppYAML is absolutely a Google App Engine thing. So it routes the requests among the different Python scripts. We will play with this as our programs get more complex. And so this is the code for our index.py. Now, I'll warn you that the application I'm about to show you is kind of like this low-level, nasty sort of hammer way of doing things. There's much easier and more elegant ways, but we're going to start out with the uneasy, unelegant way. So that when you see the easy, elegant way, you don't complain about it. Because if I showed you the elegant way, you'd complain about it. So I'm just going to say that if you don't use the elegant way, then you'd have to use this nasty, ugly way. So, the way it works is, your data goes in, AppYAML decides that index.py is supposed to run, and it passes as input to index.py the post data. So, and the output, whatever the output of the Python program, the prints, is what comes back out. So this data from the post is the input to the program. It's as if we were running a command line Python program. The raw post data is input to index.py, and the output is what goes back to the browser. There's no like HTML files involved here. Whatever the print statements are, that's what comes out. When we print in index.py, when we print, that goes out the network socket back to the browser. So the first thing we do is we print the fact a header that is content type colon text HTML that says, dear browser, think of this as HTML. We print a blank line, which is the indication in the HTTP response that we're switching from headers to the actual body, to the printable body, and we're using really crappy HTML. We print out a pre-tag. And then so remember that, and I've showed this a couple of times, that it sends the post, it sends some headers which actually get slurped up, but then this is the data that becomes the input to our program. And the way we read this is we say sys.standardin.read. Now, for those of you who took 502, we'd think about a raw input. This is actually more raw than raw input. This is lower than raw input. This is reading what's called the standard input directly and manually. I have a print that's commented out, and then I have a bit of Python code that parses that data and turns it into an integer. So let's take a quick look at that. Yeah. So assume that this data reads this as a string. Data gets the string guess equals 25. App Engine sort of slurps up these headers. And now we'll look at this code right here that's going to try to convert this to an integer. So we have to work from the inside out. So we'll do data.find equals. And if you recall from last week, data.find says, find me the position. I might need my animations here. Find me the position of the equal sign. And that is position 5 in that string. Then advance 1. So that's the 2. And then I use string slicing to say go from 6 to the end of the string, and so that means that this data, subdata find equals plus 1 to the end of the string. This bit right here is the string 2.5. And then if I take the int of the string 2.5, then I get the number 25, or a traceback. Right? For those of us who know our Python, or a traceback. But all in one line, I could have done this with a few lines if I wanted to, but all in one line, I skip past the equal sign by one character, I pull from there to the end of the line, and I pull the string out, and then I convert it to an integer. So let's just see if we can't cause a traceback in our little program. Oh, crap. I can't cause a traceback because I'm too clever. I have a try and accept block. I'm so smart, I guess. Yeah, I'm so smart. The problem is that there's actually no data the first time through on the get, so it would die and blow up. It'd be fun to have a traceback. Here, let's do this. I'll just put this in right here. Just so we can see a traceback. So now I'm going to submit the query. Yay! Traceback. Look at that. Just looks like Python. Just reminds you of 502. We got a traceback. Says you can't convert integers with base 10 if that's your string. Okay, so I'll take this line back out and let the conversion happen in the try so that it turns that into negative 1. I'll hit enter and do a get request. So now I'll do 26. And if I do whatever, it'll turn that into negative 1 with the try and accept. So we do a try and accept to make sure that when we pull that 25 off, it's right. Then we have a series of if-then-elses, well, ifs that decide to print out those two lines. First, it prints out this first line, your guess, what the current guess is, whether it's too low or not. So it prints the second line of whether it's too low, and so that's coming out of let me just do it in code. Code's better than slides. So it prints out the guess. Then it does the series of three ifs to tell me whether it's too low, too high. Then it ends the pre-code. So it ends the pre-tag, so it prints out a slash pre-tag. And then it prints the form out. And it uses the Python triple quote form, where the triple quote form goes through lines, and it nicely even puts the new lines out for me. And so then it makes sure that, you know, whether the thing runs in a get or a post or whatever, I still have the form at the bottom. And so that's how I get the form every single time. And if you do few source, you basically could see a sort of one-to-one correspondence between, you know, the print statement. That came out of a print statement. That came out of a print statement. That came out of a print statement. Print statement. Then this is kind of that long, ugly print statement at the end, but with the new lines exactly as in there, because that triple quote form, this bit right here really turns into a new line character right there. And so it prints out a new line, which is exactly as you would expect. It's kind of a not surprising result. It's a good result. It looks the way you want it to look. So you can kind of sort of cheese your way through doing this stuff, and it just kind of works out the way you want. Here, one other quick observation about this is one of the reasons that it's considered cool Python form to use single quotes for strings, even though you can use either ones, is you notice how conveniently I'm using double quotes in HTML, because HTML requires double quotes. So if I use single quote strings, I can just schlep double quotes in with reckless abandon, right? I don't have to escape them. So that's a good reason to use single quotes in your Python strings, so that if what you're doing is emitting HTML, the double quotes look reasonable. Okay. So, not that. Where did my, where did my slides go? They're right in front of my nose. So basically what we're doing in this very low level thing is we are taking the exact post data, routing through the app YAML as the standard input to a program. We're parsing that standard input, printing responses to that input, and then coming out. So any questions? So one of the things that that I mentioned when we were talking about Python is that loops in the web are not quite as loopy. We're not as obsessed with loops on the web, because if you look at this is straight line code. It starts at the top, runs to the bottom, and then finishes. There's no loops involved. It's straight line code, and the loop basically is done by the browser. Right? 24, run the code. 34, run the code. 555, run the code. So it's like the request response cycle, the browser making further requests, is what really turns into the looping activity in this. Now that doesn't mean you don't have loops inside of the server. It just means that when we're kind of doing command line data analysis with Python, loop is sort of like the organizing principle, whereas the request response cycle is the organizing principle that really replaces the loop. So there's no loop, and the main thing is not a loop. It's receive something, process it, generate a result. Wait. Receive something, process it, generate a result. Then the loop is done by the browser. Okay. So let's talk about some more form fields, just sort of so we can hit these things and get through them. So one of the things that you can put inside of a form is a field set tag and a legend. This is one of the few places in default HTML formatting that I actually kind of like it. Most of the time I hate the default formatting, but this is kind of pretty. So you can have a field set. Now in this case I only have one field, but it's a way to kind of draw a little box around your fields, and then the legend is the way to put kind of a title on it. So it's kind of nice. If I had a couple of inputs, I'd get more in here. So field set and legend are two tags. We have a number of different input types: text, password, checkbox, radio button, hidden, and submit forms. So text input we've already played with. There's this label for tag, which is a hint to the browser. It's kind of like a span tag. It is connecting a label with its text. And this is useful for screen readers, because when people are tabbing through multiple fields on a form, it can look at the label for and then read. There's no real way to say alt here. So if someone with a screen reader has tabbed into this input field, it can use the connection between the ID of the field and the label for and read it this, right? So it doesn't have to just take the fact that they're physically close together as the indication that somehow that is the label for the field. You can positively indicate to a screen reader that that text, enter your name, is the label for the field that's got an ID of name in. So this is good practice to put label for. You'll notice that I don't always do good practice. I keep it a little sloppy sometimes. So the ID is something we've talked about in HTML and CSS. Every tag can have an ID on it. It can have a class on it. If you remember, the ID has to be unique across the entire document. So this is a way to mark this particular input tag and give it sort of a variable name within the HTML document. The name is different. The name is the variable name we're going to use when we send it back to the server. So guess equals nameimp is something that's relevant in the HTML. Name equals is relevant when we send the stuff to the server. So this notion of connecting label and its corresponding input field, that's just an HTML concept. And so there's no real, that doesn't matter from the server's perspective. JavaScript, if it's running on the browser, which we'll talk about in a bit, will care a lot about this. JavaScript will care less about this. This is really the contract between this form and the server and what variable name to use when sending data to the server. You can have a default value in one of these things, and so that's how you have a form field that has data in it before you start. A password type looks just like a text type, except that it puts asterisks out on the screen. It's important to note that it's only hiding it from people looking over your shoulder. The actual data is sent in plain text up to the server. And this is why you want to use HTTPS on any form that's sending passwords, because even though you say it's a password field, it's not particularly encrypted when it's sent, but it is hidden from view of people looking over the shoulder of you. So that's the only purpose of the password field. Otherwise, it's exactly the same as a text field. And the ID is to connect with this label for, and name is, that is what I'm going to use as the variable name as I pass it to the server. A hidden field is just like a text field, except you don't see it. And it's very common to send data when, because these forms are being generated by your application. So you're writing a form, you're writing it all out in your code. And you might actually want to pass a variable value back to yourself. So you throw in a hidden field so that on the incoming post, you get that value back. It might be like what the current item that you're looking at, catalogs. Maybe you're doing post and you want it to stay on the same catalog item. It's not hidden from... It's not really securely hidden, it's just not showing up in the rendered HTML. So, let me see if I can find a hidden one somewhere. Let's see if I can find... Yeah, it'll be too hard. It'll be too hard. I'll have to look too long to find a hidden one. Hidden is like a text field, but it doesn't render. You can see them in view source, so it's not that hidden. It's only hidden from the rendered HTML. Checkboxes. And so a checkbox is the way that we put this text in and we hit the checkbox. Checkboxes, you can have as many of them as you like. So here's one called terms. Here's one called offers, right? And they're completely independent. You can check any combination of the checkboxes. You can indicate whether or not you want the checkbox to be checked or not. So whether you want the check to appear when it starts. A radio button is a situation where you can only have one of them selected at the same time. Of course, it's an homage to the radio buttons from the 60s and 70s in cars where you push a button and all the other buttons pop out and you only have one button pushed in, unless of course you sort of push two at the same time and they kind of get stuck. But it's an homage to that basic notion. And the thing about radio buttons is they're connected based on their name. So you'll find that you can actually spread radio buttons kind of out in weird places. Not that it's a good idea from a usability perspective, but the browser says all of the radio buttons with the same name being the variable name we're going to send to the server, all the radio buttons with the same name, you can only have one of those turned on. Okay? And the way the server works is each of them also has a different value, hopefully. And based on whichever one is checked, the server sees time slot, which is the variable name, equals, and one of these values. Now, it doesn't have to be a string. It could be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or whatever. And so that's how you are told which of these radio buttons is checked. And as soon as you click a different one, the other ones with the same name are unset. Unlike checkboxes, which are independent, these are totally dependent. They don't have to be right next to each other. They don't even have to be in any sane order. It just says all the things with the same name are bound together, and only one of them can be on at the same time. And you can pick one to be checked. It's not so happy if you pick multiple, but it finds a way to solve that. And so you can have a default one that your server code basically generates, say, where the checkbox is. A drop-down list is a very common technique where you have sort of this little upside-down carrot where you hit on it and it drops a thing down. And basically you start it with a select and slash select, and you tell it the name again is the variable. We're going to send this to the server. So this is going to be role equals something. And then you have a series of options, and then you have values, much like the radio button. The value determines what is sent to the server after the equal sign for role equals 2 or role equals 3 or role equals 4, and you can have a pre-selected one by saying selected equals selected on the drop-down list. Any questions? Well, often you're like editing something, right? It might, you know, you might have created this before, and the previous value of this sitting in a database might pick what the selected one is. So if you pulled up a form and it's got all your things, like in CTools, see the 600 thing? Right? I made it 600. If I change it and I make it 450, it went up, goes and updates a database. Oh, but I'm in 572. Doesn't matter. So now it's 450. So that's telling it. So it had to look up in a database to pick which of the ones was my previous thing, and I'll set it back to 600 and save it. So that's really what the selected is. If there is something that you want to be the selected one, often data pulled from a database. Sure. text input is sort of your long single line. Text areas are these blocks of text where you have rows and columns. Just like all the input fields, they have a name, which is what we send this data. And they have IDs for, you know, browser kind of local things like the ID label 4. And unlike in the other ones, you actually put the old data in between text area and slash text area because it's expected to be a relatively large amount of stuff. And there is all kinds of little bits of software. This is kind of an old one. I'll just fix it right now. So there is JavaScript code that is very rich and complex that turns these text areas into rich text areas. If we take a look at CTools here, click this options page. See this thing here? It says, hello and welcome to SI539. If I do a view source on that, you will see it's just a form. Sweet. It's a form. It's got a method post. It's got a label for. It's got input type text. Got a select box. It's got some options with 600 pixels selected. And then you see a text area tag. Now it's kind of ugly after this, but basically it's just a text area tag. And the reason this is ugly is it's got less thans and greater thans, but this is just a bunch of text. And then at the end, here's the text area. Okay? And that's what we're seeing here. This is the text area. It says, hello and welcome to SI 539, blah, 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 blah. Now, JavaScript grabs onto that text area. Oops. JavaScript grabs onto the text area and adds all the crap to the top and the bottom of it. Okay? So that's how these fancy text editors work, is they come in JavaScript and alter. So, you know, here's the FCK editor. Oh, we're using it already in production. That's cool. So text areas can become sort of rich text areas simply by the addition of JavaScript. There's no input tag that says I'm a rich text area. There is just a text area tag, and if you don't have JavaScript and you don't turn on the FCK editor, it looks kind of like what this screenshot looks like, which is just sort of a place to put stuff. And if you add JavaScript, it puts all the extra crap in. I personally hate that because it's slow. I'm all about speed. If you're gonna do a file upload, you have an input type equals file, and you give it the variable name. The entire file data appears to your application as like one variable with a bunch of stuff in it, and what kind of data that you're interested in. This is generally not done, but you can tell it I want a GIF or whatever. And so it receives it, and this turns out to just be another variable for you. And so data in is the name of that variable. Then you have to add submit buttons to click on the submit. Of course, lots of things do automatic submitting. You can also use the enter key, can be in an input field and hit the enter key and it submits the form. But the classic way to do this is to create submit buttons. You can have more than one submit button, and it's a little bit weird where, you know, you can either have different variable names here or names and values, and it sends as the parameter the name of the clicked button and the value of the clicked button. The thing that's kind of weird about this is this value tends to want to be internationalized and translated text, so the word submit, that's only the English word submit. This, and so you're sort of sending, you know, le submit or whatever you'd say in French as sort of a variable here. And so this isn't the most elegant solution because in most of these other input tags, the value is kind of an abstract number that's really for the program's consumption. But in the submit button, this turns out to be user visible text. You know, what I'm saying here is, here on the drop-down list, this value which gets sent as the parameter is like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's just like programmy stuff. And the text to be shown in the user interface is not the value. So the weird thing about submits is this one thing is both what's displayed in the UI and what is sent as the key value. So submits are a little bit weird in that respect. It would be neat, it would be nice if there was a way to say, here's the text to put on the submit button, and then here is the value to send if this submit button was pressed. Sometimes what they do is they actually just change the variable name to be something else, and so that they can just look at the variable name and then ignore the value. Any questions? Okay. So we have one more little program to go take a look at. Let me go ahead and start this one up. Okay, so this is sort of a very low level. You'll be glad that we don't do this the rest of the semester, but we're going to start showing you kind of the raw data that's being sent back and forth between these Python applications. And then the next thing we'll learn is how Python gives you a framework, App Engine gives you a framework, so you can ignore all this detail. But we're going to start out and just show you the detail and how ugly things can get. I mean, I've given you simple stuff, but this is sort of going to show you how ugly things can get. Okay, so we're going to work deep inside the depths of the machine, but we will leave as quickly as we enter. So what this does is this application creates a form, prints it out so that we can submit form data, and it dumps its input variables, sort of the environment, what's called the environment variables, about the server. And it's really this very most basic view of a web application. It's really using the old ways. And this was originally how web applications were written. They could be written in Perl. They could be written in C. They could be written in any low language by seeing standard input and these environment variables that are being sent in. So we won't write code this way, but we'll just look at it one time. And so the Common Gateway interface was this set of rules that said, if we're going to send data to a web application, here's how we're going to do it. And so it's take that raw HTTP request and hand it off to an application. And it includes things like headers. Headers can be sent along on the GET request. We can send POST data if it's a POST request. So this is a classic old page. This is what the web used to look like. You know, one document, one image, and a bunch of text, and Times Roman. The only difference between now and 1994 was the background was gray in 1994 for this document. It's kind of nice that they just left it alone. So when a request comes into App Engine, the rules of CGI, they tried as hard as they could in App Engine to follow the rules of CGI, so if you wanted to write nasty low-level code, you could. There's a set of things called environment variables. Server name, document path, all come in as a single dictionary object. And then the POST input is handed to us as the standard input. We've already parsed guess equals 25 that came from standard input. And then whatever the program prints goes to the browser. And so, again, this allows you to write Perl or C or write your web apps in really low languages with no frameworks whatsoever. But we'll see how that hurts in a while. And so you can think of this as, in our browser, we have this form. We fill in some stuff. The POST data becomes based on the names of the fields, and the contents of the fields, turns into some POST data that's sent, and once it's passed one variable, you have an ampersand, and there's actually ways to encode ampersands in here. So the zap equals stuff, zod equals more stuff, that is sent as the standard input to our CGI program. And the environment data, like what the path was and what kind of server version we're running and all kinds of other junk, come in a Python dictionary. And the POST data comes in, and then we can write print. So we're gonna play at this low level just once. So if we look at this program, it starts out and prints out, has some import statements, so that it can get at some library code. It prints out that this is an HTML document, prints a blank line to indicate that that's the end of the headers. Then it just prints a form out, And that form is rendered this way. The headers don't show, but this header has an effect because it knows to represent all this stuff as HTML. The import of sys is just, you can go read the documentation on that. This is how we talk to this low-level input of standard input. The OS is talking to what's called the operating system. OS stands for operating system, and it's the way we get at our environment variables. So the first thing we're going to do is print out the environment variables. And os.environ is a dictionary. So if you remember in your Python, we can loop through a dictionary by asking for a list of the keys and then write a for loop to go successively through all the keys, and then we can print out the name of the key followed by a colon sign and then look up using dictionary syntax the value of that key. So this prints out environment keys, and then it prints out the first parameter and its value. HTTP cookie colon camtools pref equals server software equals development slash 1.0 script name colon request method get. So if I wanted to see if it was a get request, I could look in this under the key request method. These are just strings in a dictionary. So these are just the keys in the dictionary. And it's just like what server? Well, this was running on port 8081. What address did this come from? What's our server name? And this is all giving you all the data. Now in a simple program, we don't need any of this data. But there's other things where whether it was a get or a post might be useful to us. And so we could look up in this dictionary. But all it's doing right now is dumping all this stuff out. Any questions? The next thing it does is it opens sys standard in. And now, instead of reading the whole thing, I'm going to read only the first, read and print the first 100 lines. Okay? And so it prints out data, and then it reads up to the first 100 lines. That's because we're going to mess with it and make it kind of ugly. But in the classic simple post where we've got two parameters, or two variables, zap and zap. Oops, that's, I probably should call that zot. But it just gives the key values, okay? Now, there's an encoding rule for all this data, like spaces are encoded as pluses. And you have to go read the spec to find out what the encoding rules are. So my little thing where we did guess equals 25, that was sort of the simplest, most ideal case. But there's decoding of this data you got to do. It gets ugly fast. Okay. And so if I just take a look at this program, it prints out a form. It loops through the environment keys and prints them out, and then it prints out the CGI, that should say post data. Fix that. Should print out the post data, only the first 110 lines. Okay, so here's what it looks like when I do a get request. And it tells me like I'm on port 887 and what the URL was that I used to get to this. What host contact, what's the IP address of the host that called me, that's how they do IP tracking, the application that's running, the kind of data, and down here there's no data. And so if I put some data in and press post, I've got it complex. Hang on, let me fix this. I'll take this part out, and I'll put that back in a second. Oh, I just killed the submit button. Put that back in. So I have two text fields. I get the entire environment, and then here I go. This is the input data that I get. Now, and so, and, oh, let me send that in with a blank, and you'll see the plus show up. Two words. So if I submit that, you see that the blank turns into a plus. You see that the second parameter shows up as zot with an ampersand equals. So the parsing of this could get really complex. But if you want to do files, you actually have to encode the data a different way, what's called multipart form data. And then I will ask for a uploaded file. And so now if I hit refresh, if I say first, second, then let's choose a little file. And now I'm going to upload the file. So hit submit. And this multipart form data, it tells me that it's coming in as multipart form data. So instead of giving that single line, it actually breaks it into a series of things. So the first thing is zap, which is first, and that's how much it takes to describe that zap equals first. The second thing it finds is zot equals second, and then the third thing it finds is, oh, dude, here's a file. This guy uploaded a whole file of stuff. And then here is the actual file itself. This is an RTF file, so it looks like junk, right? And then it has these dash, dash, dash things. And so if you wanted to parse this, you have to find zap equals first, zot equals second. You got to read through all this data. So I'm just dumping it right now, okay? And so I only show you that example not because I want you to learn about how to do that. You'd have to read lots and lots of HTML documents and HTTP documents, and frankly, you would spend forever trying to get that right. So we actually have frameworks that do understand this stuff quite nicely for us and parse this keyword data and don't care, know all the different ways it can be represented and hand it to us in a very simple and useful fashion. So,